and said, "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, for she was taken out of man." That's why a man leaves his father and mother and is united to his wife, and they become one flesh. Adam and his wife were both naked, and they felt no shame.
Thanks, John. I wonder if you could just keep that open. In front of you, the mic is on, just there for now. So whenever I have a meeting with Ben, I always walk into the meeting without even a pencil or a pen. I'm one of those people that kind of goes from one week to the next without really thinking too much about anything. But Ben invariably has a list, and the list can be, and he works through his list as we speak. And so this summer we had a meeting about the autumn preaching plan, and Ben, as usual, had a list. And he said, "You know what, Mark, I think you really need to be speaking about sex and sexuality and relationships and all of those things." And I said, "Ben, feel free to do that one. I'm very happy for you to try that." And he said, "No, you're much more experienced in this than I am." And he kind of flattered me. And so we agreed that this would be the day we would tackle that subject. And then at the end of the meeting, he said, "Oh, by the way, the 15th of October. I think I'm in Yorkshire that weekend." So if you're not seeing Ben, you know where he is. And I think I was right to be nervous, because our society is saturated with input on identity and sex, isn't it? It's just saturated with all kinds of billions of hours of programming in all kinds of formats, with a million shades of opinion, and some of those shades of opinion are distressing, some are disturbing, and others just plain vapid. And it's daunting for me to stray even for a few minutes into this particular minefield. I've been doing these kinds of talks for 30 years, and as I look back over what I said 5, 10, 15, 20, 25 years ago, it has become far more complicated, far more difficult to understand how to address the issues. Because we're living in a time of dramatic change. In the past, if you had a new idea, you'd have to print it, put it into books or leaflets, and hope people buy it and then read your idea. Of course, with the advent of radio, that became much more immediate, and with television, much more immediate again. But of course, today, with Facebook or YouTube, you can express an opinion which will be seen by a million people within an hour, potentially. You can say something on Twitter that will be responded to by a prince or a president, especially this president. And the instant communication revolution is driving social change at a breakneck speed. Absolutely a breakneck speed. And it's uncomfortable for people like myself who have a bedrock commitment to a set of values that spans thousands of years. And it's hard not to feel that in some ways what I've always known to be true is being outmaneuvered and somehow presented as being negative. When I was a young person, the values of Christianity on sexuality were held by most of society. Even in the 1960s when I was born. And now it feels like if you hold to those values that you're somehow against society and what you're doing is somehow subversive and bad. So if you're confused by sex, identity, and purpose, I'm right there with you. And the purpose this morning isn't to make people feel uncomfortable or to say things that offend people. The purpose is to examine truth and just lay truth out and understand it and respond to it. Now, I don't usually promote the ministries of other pastors, especially pastors whose churches are literally a stone's throw from here, and who I suspect are better preachers than I am. But I have got to know Ed Shaw from Emmanuel just down the road over the last couple of years, and he's written a wonderful book, The Plausibility Problem, on same-sex attraction. He's written it from a very personal perspective, and that's really a great read. I would encourage you to read that. And one of the elders from Emmanuel, Glenn Harrison, whose home, I believe we have home grouping, right? It's Glenn's house, yeah? Yeah, so we actually have a home group in his house, but he's never there. He's come at the same issue from a more sociological perspective and talking about it more historically, but again, he's a practicing psychiatrist. He's got an awful lot of very good things to say. And I certainly enjoyed reading one of those books this week, and John did kind of give me the synopsis of the other. And one of the things they say is that the criticisms of the church are justified in some sense, and they are justified. We've got no business maligning people or sidelining them or vilifying people over sexuality. That's just wrong. people who experience same-sex attraction or question their gender. In the ministry of Jesus, if you look at the ministry of Jesus, the people who enter the kingdom of heaven are not the self-righteous, self-satisfied people. They are the people who regard themselves as being on the margins of society. And if we find ourselves with the self-righteous, self-satisfied, and we find ourselves vilifying people who are different to us, then we are working against the kingdom of heaven and not working with the kingdom of heaven. And crucially, I want to say that we come together united by the fact that every person in this room has distorted sex. We have all distorted sex, and we all distort it in a variety of ways, as we've distorted every other part of our lives. And we're all living with the hangover, what the Bible calls sin, which is messed up behavior, and it can be manifested sexually or even in cold, hard self-righteousness. And so we all come to BC3 with the understanding that we need to change. Everyone needs to change. And that this is a place where change can happen. And change is a good thing. And change is a helpful thing. And crucially, I want to say we don't define people by what happens in the bedroom. We don't define people by what's happening sexually in their lives. The Bible defines people on the basis of the family of God. And the Bible defines those who are in the family of God as children of God. And it offers an invitation to those who are out of the family of God to become children of God. And that is the definition that the Bible places over people. And yet in coming to sex and sexuality and identity, it does feel like something's gone terribly wrong. A recent article entitled Why Millennials Aren't Having Sex, I think crystallizes it very interesting. I'm just going to read some of it, and some of it's up here too. Why are millennials not having sex? That's the takeaway from a recent study explored in a viral story from the Washington Post. According to the new report, 15% of 20 to 24-year-olds have not had sex since 2018, up from 6% in the early 1990s. And millennials reported fewer sexual partners than any group since the 1960s. So what's going on here? The Post hypothesizes that millennials are too focused on their careers to do the deed. And as the piece notes, this generation is called the most cautious generation, the first to grow up with car seats and bike helmets, the first not to be allowed to walk to school or go to the playground alone. Apparently, millennials are afraid of what they call catching feelings. It's true, relationships can get emotional, so better not risk it. But I think there's another force at work here, technology. Technology is giving people unrealistic expectations of a mate. There's Tinder, which is quite possibly invented purely to destroy the fabric of society. Then there's Xbox. As the economist Eric Hirst notes, young men are spending a lot of time playing video games. And most importantly, there's porn. The Post interviews an 18-year-old virgin male who's not really interested in having sex because he'd rather watch YouTube. But isn't he curious about the actual sex? Not really, he says. I've seen so much of it. There's nothing really magical about it, right? Almost everything worthwhile in life requires a good education. Someone who's eating junk food their entire life is probably unable to appreciate real good food because their taste buds and nerve responses have been sort of trained by sugar and saturated fats. So let me just say, no dude, there isn't anything magical about the kind of sex you see in porn. For that matter, there isn't anything magical about hookups. You know what's magical? Catching feelings. Catching feelings. That's magical. That's magical. And he said the nail on the head. It's hit the nail on the head. Catching authentic, life-changing feelings is miraculous. It's beautiful. And it beats input every day of the week. And catching feelings and intimacy is what lies at the heart of life, whether you're having sex or whether you're not having sex. Sex, like everything else, can be used as a pathway towards intimacy or can be trampled on and distorted as we drive our way through life. But if we distort it, it is soon broken and will be left on the side of the road. One of the biggest tragedies that I have as a middle-aged man, and I work in education, and most of my colleagues, they're either just a little bit older or a little bit younger than me, and I have a lot of friends there, and some of them are gay and some of them are straight. What I find amazing is that intimacy is not part of their lives. It's not that they're having wrong sex, they're just not having sex at all. Intimacy is not there. People you would expect to be starting families are showering their love and affection on household pets. People who are living with someone are more often not living with them as a roommate. As a roommate. They don't even go on a holiday with their partners. And there's a loss of intimacy in the young due to porn, made worse by porn. And there's a lack of intimacy in the older because the guests can't be bothered anymore. And in the Bible we see the beginning of sex, identity, we see the purpose of life. So let's just turn again to Genesis 2. And I want to say three things about Genesis 2 just very shortly this morning. I have no problem accepting Genesis 2 as a literal account. I've thought about it for many years. I have no problem at all with that. If that's a struggle for you, you don't have to, for the purpose of this talk, accept it as a literal account. You just have to accept it as a story which is teaching truth. Because I believe that the Genesis 2 account, but for me, I believe it is literal, but I think it's also just teaching truth in a way which is universal. And I want to pick out three themes from this passage. I don't want to read the text again because I've got a lot to get through. But the first theme is identity. Identity. And it'll come up here, the relevant passages, okay? What is the origin of the species? The origin of the species is that God took dust, took stuff that was worthless, breathed life into it, and created a living creature. Humanity was created as an icon of God. We are God's icons. The galaxies do not bear his name. The oceans tell us nothing about him. But we, men and women, have been formed by him in his image, in his likeness, to be like him. And that makes humanity special. And it means that you cannot reduce humanity to the level of an animal. Because we have been formed by God to be his image bearers, to bear his image throughout all eternity. And he puts people into an environment where they can flourish, where there's food, where there's shelter, there's beauty all around, and then he stands back and enjoys the relationship. But he looks at the man and he says, no, there's something missing. The man needs a suitable helper. He needs somebody who will fit with him in a way that he and I will never fit. So he says, I'm going to form a partner. And he puts the man to sleep and he takes the woman from the man's flesh, and the man wakes up and there's a woman and she's perfectly compatible. Where he is weak, she is strong. And where she is strong, he is weak. And that's the foundation of marriage. But it's also the foundation for all of life, whether you're married or not. We were not designed to live our lives in isolation. But I have to say, male and female are designed to fit together. All you have to do is look at the human body naked and you get there about by yourself. It's something a 5-year-old can tell you. Men and women are designed to fit and be compatible together in a way that men are not designed to fit with men and women are not designed to fit with women. They complement each other. They support each other in unique ways. 35 years ago when I was at university, I did psychology, and my female psychology professor had to spend the first semester, the first 3 or 4 months, looking at the differences between men and women. I won't be sacked today if she tried to do that. And she was, I don't think she was a Christian or had any faith at all, but she was thrilled by the myriad of differences between men and women. And in her teaching, you could see how she just was fascinated by it. And one thing I worry about identity in our society is the way that truth is being negated and suppressed. And I worry when I see people calling black white and calling white black. And not only that, but punishing you if you don't go along with that. It's an extremely destructive thing to do. It's what the Bible calls, I think, iniquity. It's being deliberately perverse. And as a person, we've been created by an ultimate father, someone who watches over us in an environment that where we can have joy and completeness. In many cases with a partner in the context of marriage, but always, hopefully, with groups of people in the context of a community like this one. Sharing life defines us. It determines, it helps us to be free. True freedom is not doing whatever you can imagine. True freedom means becoming who you are in the context that God has put you. There's something beautiful in intimacy, in a giving of oneself, and a preferring of oneself over, preferring of others over self. And yet we have to face the fact that we have all distorted this, and our natural tendency is to distort this. And for, instead of intimacy uniting people, power and manipulation enter into relationships, and intimacy is used to destroy people. In 1999, the dance band The Bloodhound Gang released a seminal album, You and Me Baby, We Ain't Nothing But Mammals, So Let's Do It Like They Do It on the Discovery Channel. Do you remember that? I sure do. I'm not going to sing it again for you right now. In key. Why? Because there was a pounding beat, wasn't there? Boom, 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 boom. And it was just two lines of the song. What are they saying? They're saying all of this purpose doesn't exist. We're just animals. And so sex is just something we do for pleasure, and it's something we do just together, but there's no purpose to it. And that sucks the joy and the purpose out of life. It crushes identity, and it takes away the purpose of living, and it leaves me jaded and bleeding on the ground. If there is no God, and I've not been created by Him to be intimate with Him and to be intimate with other people, and if I'm an animal, then ultimately, what is the purpose of life? I might as well kill myself. And having distorted sex, we've opened the door to an even crueler attack on identity. Glenn Harrison, who I mentioned earlier, has written a book, and in chapter in the book is called A Better Story. And he tracks what he calls gender ideology. And gender ideology is a movement which separates gender from chromosomes. And it takes the experience of gender dysphoria, and gender dysphoria is a personality disorder where a small number of individuals, and by small I mean small, 0.005% of men, 0.001% of women, struggle for one reason or another with who they are in their body. And but what gender ideology has done, it has mainstreamed that disorder and put that into the center of society. And it has said, this is brave, this is radical, this is redefining people's ability to be even more in control of their lives. It's a celebration of brokenness. And Harrison, who I've already said is a practicing psychiatrist, writes this, gender ideology makes gender something located in people's inner feelings rather than something grounded in their own untrustworthy external bodies. In this worldview, the bearing being fully human and truly flourishing means going with your inner feelings rather than following those externally imposed norms. And another movement is to put this at the center of society and say, these people who are living with gender dysphoria are leading the way, and we should all be like them, and we should all be able to choose whether we're male or female today. But this is nothing less than a terrible attack on the very essence of who we are. I teach troubled teenagers, and Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, I come home exhausted from interacting with teenagers who are troubled. And on a weekly basis, I will sit with a teenager, and they will have their arm up, and I will see slash marks across their arms, or there will be a scab, and they're picking at the scab, picking and picking at the scab. And what is it? Self-harming. What kind of lunatic would I be if I were to say, wow, that's really cool. Why don't you come to the front of the class and show us what you've done there? Maybe we can all copy you. That's crazy. It's crazy. Gotta be vile. By taking your own sexual identity and making it something that you're making up as you go along, it is a form of self-harming on the inner being of who you are. It's like taking a knife, opening up your life, and slashing your inner identity. Because our identity as male and female is the foundational essence of who we are. People with gender dysphoria are 19 times more likely to kill themselves. 40% of those people have attempted suicide. It is an attack on the inner person, which is so destructive. 20 years ago, I was pastoring in Rome. I was pastoring a guy who he had a lot of issues, and he was an alcoholic, and every now and then he'd stray into heroin for a little bit. And when he had a drink, he told me that one year during carnival, he went to the carnival with his girlfriend, and he was in drag, and they went to carnival together. And then they went back home to his house, and they had sex. And he said, it was the most amazing sexual experience of my life. But he said, something funny has happened since then. I can no longer feel aroused in a normal sexual situation. And so then, every time he had a drink, he would get in his car, which was already scary, and drive to Aeor, which was 5 miles down the road. And it's an area where there are transvestite prostitutes. And he would have sex with one of those guys in drag. And I said to him, are you gay? He said, no. I said, well, what's going on there? And he said, I don't know. That night, something broke. Something changed. And this is now what I do. And that was 20 years ago, and as far as I know, he's still doing it now. Still doing it now. And to take a young boy or a young girl who's been exposed to pornography and have been abused, and then turns around and says, I want to change my gender, to say to that person, oh yeah, really cool, come and be a poster child so we get rid of you, is iniquitous. It's evil. Real love, catching feelings, means saying to that child, please tell me how this happened to you. Do you know that there's a father who loves you? And do you know that there's a route to completeness? That's real love. That's real love. Second thing I want to say about this passage is that this passage talks about purpose and boundaries. Purpose and boundaries. That God has a purpose for the man and then for the couple. In the parallel passage of Genesis 1, it puts this even more clearly, so I will read from Genesis 1, but it's also here on the screen. Then God said, let us make man and mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the air, over the livestock and the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move on the ground. So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves on the ground. And the verb here to rule is like a comb going through hair. God said to men and women, you have a purpose to your life, and it is to establish your authority on this earth. The purpose of men and women is that they are made in the image of God, and they have a beautiful purpose which is full of challenges and opportunities, which has good outcomes and a satisfying life. But there's a tragedy when purpose is exchanged for pleasure. When purpose is exchanged for pleasure. Robert Lustig puts it this way, these are unhappy times. Rich countries are suffering an alarming growth in addiction, anxiety and depression, and few more so than the UK, where antidepressant prescriptions have more than doubled in the past decade, and which is the scene of almost a third of Europe's drug overdoses. All manner of individual factors are behind this trend, but the true cause is that people's sense of well-being is being undermined by their incessant quest for pleasure. Modern life offers endless opportunities for people to enjoy the little fixes of dopamine, the reward neurotransmitter that tells the brain, this feels good, I want more. Thanks to the ubiquity of triggers such as sugar, tobacco, alcohol, drugs, social media, and porn. Yet the evidence suggests that all of this dopamine, particularly when combined with stress, drives down the levels of serotonin, the contentment or happiness neurotransmitter, that tells our brain, this feels good, I have enough. I don't want it or need any more. Popular culture tells us that pleasure and happiness are the same thing. It's not true. Chasing the former restricts our ability to enjoy the latter. Fleeting pleasure does not satisfy. Fleeting pleasure creates a scratch, an itch, inside to our very identity. True joy comes in understanding that we are living within boundaries, that we are not God, okay? We are not the center of the universe. We are created beings by a creator God. And we have been created to enjoy him, to serve him, and to run the comb through our environment, to cultivate our environment. We're not omnipotent, we're not omnipresent, we're not omniscient, but we thrive within boundaries. And just as a child who has no limits is not happy, but they're cross, a person who understands their limits and understands the boundaries understands true joy, true contentment. And God's intention for people is not to live as God, but to live in an intimate relationship with God, the relationship of a parent with a child, a life of dependency on Him. I have purpose because I have boundaries. And the story of the garden is a story of a tree, isn't it, of good and evil. And that tree is the boundary. And the garden is there for people to live their lives and cultivate the garden. And life is like that garden. You have to sow seeds, and you have to weed, and you have to work on it. And you're building, and sometimes it seems hard. And you create boundaries, and the boundaries get cultivated. But if you give up after 5 minutes, and you just go into entertainment and pleasure, you lose everything. But if you carry on cultivating that garment of marriage, life, you turn around at 50 and you've really got something. You've got something. You've got something that you've seen, you've developed. Now let's relate this to sex. In the billions of images and words that are churned out about sex, what I never hear is this fundamental scientific question we should always ask about everything. What's it there for? What's it there for? No one ever asks that question. What is sex there for? And you don't have to be a Christian to ask this question. You can ask it in evolutionary terms if you like. What is sex there for? Why do we have it? Well, isn't it to have babies? And to keep parents together to raise children? And to be a glue for a couple so they can live together their whole life and not only have physical children, but have spiritual children so they can cultivate that life together? Sex is there so that a new life will be entrusted to the people who've caught feelings for that life. So that a new life will be entrusted to people who biologically care for them. And sex has its place in that, as in the grand scheme of what it means to bring people together in intimacy to keep them united so that they can do that job. And people can keep going with it and can keep enjoying it for their whole lives. I'm not going to tell you some jokes about 80-year-old people, but they can. They really can. They keep going with it for their whole lives. Because it's a bond. It's keeping them together. Then God made the man, woman from the rib, and he had taken out the man, and he brought it to the man. The man said, "This now is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She should be called woman, for she was taken out of a man. And that is why a man leaves his father and mother, and is united to his wife, and they become one flesh. And Adam and Eve and his wife were both naked, and they felt no shame." Intimacy. What we see here in this passage is intimacy. They are both naked, and they feel no shame. They are naked before God, and they feel no shame. They're naked with each other, and they feel no shame. And the sex act is an act where people are naked together and they're creating a union out of love. And there is no shame. There's only intimacy. But of course, it's a very powerful act. If you go to Venice, you can go to visit Murano, one of his islands, and you'll see people blowing glass. And when they're blowing glass, it kind of comes out of the tube and it's very liquid. But of course, as soon as the glass is chilled or cooled, it becomes brittle. And that's what sex is. When you're having sex with someone and you take your clothes off, you're being intimate with them. What you're doing is, it's like hot glass being formed. You're creating a bond with that person. You're creating a bond with them. And when that glass is, when the glass is cooled, if you then snap off the bond, you're left with a razor sharp jagged edge. A razor sharp jagged edge. And that jagged edge is on the inside of you, destroying our very essence. And that's why sex is within boundaries. That's why there has to be union with people who are compatible physically and spiritually. Sex is something you do with somebody with whom you're going in the same direction, with whom you're walking in the same direction, with whom you share the same values. If you are creating a bond with Christ, and then you create a bond with somebody who fundamentally hates Christ, you are splitting yourself up. And you are weakening your relationship with Christ, and you weaken your relationship with that person, because you're going in separate directions. If you love someone who loves Jesus, loving Jesus would define everything you do. It would define the way you raise your children, the way you work, everything. And if you're united to somebody who doesn't love Jesus, then neither relationship will prosper. Because the central intimacy is not between a man and a woman. The central intimacy is between a person and God. And that intimacy is the one that lasts forever. And that creates a context for the other forms of intimacy. And spiritual intimacy with Christ builds intimacy on a variety of levels. Paul wasn't married. He writes to Timothy, a young man, who was his apprentice and then co-worker. And weeks or so before Paul dies, he writes to Timothy. Listen to what he writes. "To Timothy, my dear son, grace, mercy, and peace from God the Father and the Lord Jesus Christ. I thank God whom I serve as my ancestors did, with a clear conscience. As night and day, I constantly remember you in my prayers. Recalling your tears, I long to see you, so that I might be filled with joy. I am reminded of your sincere faith, which first lived in your grandmother Lois and your mother Eunice, and am now persuaded now lives in you." Can you see the intimacy? He had a friendship with that person. And that friendship was not a sexual friendship, but it was an intimate friendship. And it was an intimate relationship which could be healing. And intimacy lies at the heart of a wonderful marriage, but it lies at the heart of great friendships, wonderful home groups, and hopefully a church like this. It's the core of what it means to be born again. And that perfect intimacy with God fulfills you and keeps you, and it helps you to no longer desire intimacy outside of that. But you long for intimacy within that. In The Plausibility Problem, Ed Shaw, who writes about living with same-sex attraction, says, "The power of sexual temptation lessens the more time I spend among friends with whom I'm not sexually active." Intimate. He said the power of sexual temptation is diminished by being intimate with people, being open with them. I remember I was listening this morning, the last time I had a cigarette was 1986. And 1986, done pretty well. And I was studying here in Bristol, and we were going across the States to live with my parents for a month. I was already married. And I thought, my parents don't like the fact I smoke, and so this would be a chance to give up smoking. So I went to this new context with in the States. And just, you know, if you want to give up smoking, it's a good thing to step out of the context, you know what I mean? It's something else. And I was there, and I didn't really feel the urge or desire for a cigarette. But then, on the final day, my parents took us to the airport, and I was sitting there, and I suddenly felt this overwhelming urge for a cigarette. And I thought to myself, as soon as Mom and Dad are gone, I'm going to go buy a packet of cigarettes. And I suddenly felt a real conviction of sin. Not about buying cigarettes, but because of how I felt about my parents. So I thought to myself, I'm not going to see my parents for another 5 years or 2 years or 3 years or whatever. And now I'm wishing them away. And so I turned to my mother and I said, "Mom, I got to tell you, I feel really tempted to buy a cigarette right now." And that was the last time I ever felt a pang for a cigarette. That was the last time I ever felt a pang for a cigarette. That temptation just went. Now, how did it go? Through sharing it in intimacy. Through sharing it in intimacy. The joy of knowing the God who walked in the garden with Adam and Eve is the same one who walked in obedience to the cross. The cross was terrible because there was a loss of intimacy on the cross. And the cross is wonderful because through the cross we can have intimacy with the Father. He gave himself on the cross and was divorced from the Father so that we could be united with him. So his healing can take away the brokenness inside of us. And here's the central core of what I want to say. Adam and his wife were both naked, and they felt no shame. Adam and his wife were both naked, and they felt no shame. And whether you are married or you're not married, whether you're ever going to be married, whether you're gay or straight or anything, describe yourself. I want to tell you, there is a home for you with the Father in perfect intimacy. There's a home for you with the Father in perfect intimacy. And that home is the most wonderful home there ever will be. And there will come a day when there'll be a big wedding feast, which will make every other wedding seem like a waste of time. And the son, the groom, will call his bride, and his bride is us. And he will say, come to the wedding feast. And we will know intimacy with him, which will satisfy us forever. We will know an openness with him that will satisfy us forever. And you, I really am not here to make people feel guilty or anything else like that. But if this morning you feel like you have been in that place where you have been ripping away at your inner being, that intimacy can heal you today. That intimacy can heal you today. That intimacy can make you complete again today. And this is the kind of place where that can happen. Because the aim of our time together is not to rock up on a Sunday morning and just enjoy singing the songs and hearing the sermons and then rushing away. The aim of our time together is to walk together in intimacy to a place where we can experience healing. And one of the biggest pains that I experience at BC3 is seeing people who we love who are living with brokenness. And you come to them and say, listen, say hello to intimacy. It's the way of healing. And they say, no, no, there's no problem, there's no problem, there's no problem. That's the terrible thing. That's the terrible thing. Our desire is not that we're undressed with everybody. But our desire is that we can be undressed with somebody, emotionally undressed. Say, this is who I am. Will you pray with me? And through that we see growth. Through that we see transformation. So is your life built around relationships? Is your life built around intimate relationships? And are those relationships taking you further into intimacy with Christ? Or are they those relationships taking you away from intimacy with Christ? The only satisfaction we can offer is intimacy with Christ. Knowing Him, loving Him, being loved by Him, and being changed by Him. Let's pray. Lord God and loving Heavenly Father, we do praise and thank You.